Okay, we're honored to have with us today the Reverend David Davis, who's the head of the Ben Noach movement in this country and probably in the world, all right? And what I'd like to do is just give a few introductory words about what our relationship is to a Ben Noach in terms of us being Yisrael, being Jews, and both from a halachic and a philosophical standpoint. Okay. I'll start off with what the what Teisva says in Teisva says in Psachim, Daf Chav Beis Amar Aleph. So Teisva says that there is a Tana that holds that a Ben Noach is also in Gid Hanasha. So Teisva asks a question. He says that how is it possible that that same Tana holds that you could send the Gid Hanasha to a non-Jew? So Teisva says no, because what he when he says that a Ben Noach is prohibited in Gid Hanasha, what he means is the only Bnei Yaakov. It means the Bnei Yaakov Kodem Matan Torah. That's the halacha. That's when it's also for a Ben Noach. So you see from Teisva's, that before Matan Torah, everybody had a halacha of a Ben Noach. All of us. It means the Avos even. The Avos. And the Rambam states this very clearly in his Igeris, in his letter, which I'll get to later. But right now, what I'd like to do is, aside from the fact that the Avos were Bnei Noach, I'd like to understand our present status as Jews. A theoretical question. I'll ask you a theoretical question. It's a halacha question. Questions like this. The question is, the idea of a Jew, of Yisrael, is a Yisrael, everybody knows that a Yisrael is, there is something Yisrael more than Ben Noach. I mean, this is there's no question about it. But my question is this. My question is it two different kinds? In other words, is Yisrael and Ben Noach, are they two different types? Or is Yisrael Ben Noach plus? That's my question. Okay. According to halacha, we like to have a clear idea of how the halacha formulates. What is the relationship between a Yisrael and between a Ben Noach? Are they two different species, or is halachically I'm speaking? We'll get to philosophically. We'll speak about it a little later. But halachically, because halacha has to have a certain formula to it. So the question is, what is a Yisrael? Is Yisrael a Ben Noach plus, or is a Yisrael a different entity that was created at the time of at Sinai? All right, anybody have any want to deduce any evidence? Either way, yes, go ahead.
The Rambam says it was an extension. First,
they kept it. Oh, okay, okay, good. Okay, good. Any, good. We'll get to the Rambam. But the what about halachically, from a halachic standpoint? Okay. Well, you know, the Gemara says like this. There's a Gemara in Shabbos that says that the halacha of Mila. So Mila, circumcision, is done on the eighth day. And the Gemara says that that's only if a woman actually has a normal birth. But if it's done through cesarean section, there's no halacha, there's no law of eighth day. All right, because the Gemara says it's tied to the halacha, all those laws of tumah, of uncleanliness, and with cesarean section there is no laws of uncleanliness. Of course, the halacha is very specific. So the Gemara asks a question. The Gemara says, but you see, the eighth day goes back to Abraham, and there were no laws of uncleanliness because it was before the Torah was given. So the Gemara says, no, you can't deduce any evidence from there. Why? Because nitna Torah v'neschat shalacha. Once the Torah was given, so the Torah was given, at the time the Torah was given, it's a system unto itself. And everything that predates the Torah is basically uprooted. Now, for instance, the reason why we don't eat the Gid Hanasha, the reason why we don't eat the Gid Hanasha today is not because Jacob... In the time of Yaakov Avinu, the time of Jacob, that they didn't need to get an usher. It's because the Torah came along and endorsed the previous custom. But it starts from Sinai. It doesn't start from before Sinai. The moment Sinai began, that's when all the laws start. Certain laws that predated Sinai were reestablished, and then new laws were created. But there's nothing that we do that predates Sinai. That's called Nitna Torah v'Neschat Shalacha. Once the Torah was given, it's a whole new system, and certain things that we do, like Bris Milah, for instance, circumcision. But we don't do circumcision because of Abraham. We do because the Torah, when the Torah was given, it's said to do circumcision. It starts from the Torah. And the halacha, for instance, is like this. Halacha is, as you know, a ben Noach is not permitted to eat Aver min hachai. Aver min hachai means a limb from the living, or flesh from the living. Basar min hachai, Aver min hachai. So, and we also are prohibited from eating Aver min hachai. Okay. But there's a difference. I'll give you an example. We have a concept of shechita, which is ritual slaughter. So let's say, for instance, the shochet, the one that's slaughtering the animal, he severs both of the simonim. That's the esophagus and the trachea. So then it's considered as if the animal is ritually slaughtered, and we can eat it. But the halacha is a ben Noach really can't eat it at that point, because since he doesn't partake of the law of shechita, so for him it'll still be Aver min hachai, whereas for us it won't be Aver min hachai. So you see that there is a difference in law between the Yisrael and between the Ben Noach. Because the Ben Noach is working within his own framework, and the Yisrael is working within his own framework. So therefore we both, as long as the animal's moving, yes. Nefarcheses, as long as the animal's moving. The animal is still alive even after they sever the trachea and the esophagus, so the Ben Noach is not permitted to partake of it, whereas the Yisrael is permitted because for him it has undergone the process of shechita, whereas for the Ben Noach it still is alive. So you see that the halacha differentiates between the Ben Noach and between the Yisrael. So on the surface it would appear that it is a completely different, qualitatively different halachically, a different entity from that halacha, because we both are prohibited in Aver min hachai, yet what is Aver min hachai for one is not going to be Aver min hachai necessarily for another. So from there would appear that it's two different kinds. But the Rambam, as Richard mentioned before, the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim has a very interesting introduction to the seven laws of Noah. And he says as follows. He mentions that Adam the first received six commandments. He mentions what they are. And then he says, Noach added Aver min hachai, a limb from the living. Okay? So it was seven mitzvahs. And then the Rambam says, this is the way it was in the world until Abraham came. Abraham came and there was an addition of circumcision. Then he mentions that Abraham also prayed shacharis. He prayed the morning prayer. Yitzchak added taking tithes, and he also added the tefillah of the afternoon, which is mincha. And Yaakov added girhanosha, and he prayed the evening prayer. And he says, and in Egypt, before the Torah was given, Amram, the father of Moses, received many commandments. Until Moses came, he says, and the Torah was completed through Moses. Okay. The implication from Maimonides over here is clear, that it is not a qualitative differentiation, but on the contrary, it was a gradual process. In other words, the process began with Adam the first, and it concluded with Moses. So, according to the Rambam, you see that the concept of Torah is really not a qualitatively differentiated phenomena, but it is a quantitatively differentiated phenomena. In other words, it's an addition. There was Ben Noach, and then Abraham added, each one came along and added a mitzvah. This would seem to be in contradiction to what we just mentioned before, that in the halacha, the Ben Noach's definition of the limb is different for him than it is for the Yisrael. Correct? So my answer is as follows. My answer is that there's a difference between the systematic law itself. In terms of the systematic law, it's true that Sinai is a, Sinai is a separate entity. Sinai is a separate entity in terms of the system of the law. So the definitions of Sinai for the Yisrael Zev Menachai is different than for the Benel. There's no question about that. But what the Rambam is saying over here is that's true insofar as the system of law is concerned. But insofar as the person is concerned, that's not true. Insofar as the governor, insofar as the person is concerned, it's not true. In other words, the mitzvos, every mitzvah gives a person a certain kedusha, a certain holiness. Okay? Now, in terms of the kedusha, the holiness of the person, there is no qualitative differentiation. It is simply a matter of quantity, that every mitzvah that a person receives, if the person partakes of that mitzvah properly, he increases his own status as a human being. And therefore, that's why the Rambam says that the first Adam received the first six mitzvos, then Noach, then Abraham, because insofar as the individual, insofar as the person is concerned, there is no qualitative differentiation between a Ben Noach and between a Yisrael. There is, they both partake of the same perfection of Adam, of man. And I'd like to quote the Rambam in his Igeres, and I think the Reverend familiar with this Rambam, I think I saw you mention it once. But the Rambam says, he mentions, and this was an Igeres, a letter that was written to Rav Chasdoy HaLevi in Alexandria. He says as follows. He says, you should know that Torah requires libaboy, heart. It means the person's essence. And he says, and everything goes according to the essential nature, direction of the person's energies, his emotional energies, his intellectual energies. And that's why the rabbis say that the Chasidei Umos HaOlam, that people who are non-Jews, have a share in the world to come. If they understood the true idea of God, and if they perfect themselves in terms of their characteristics, in terms of their midos, he says, and there is no question that any human being that has perfected himself in terms of his personality, in terms of his midos, and in terms of his knowledge and understanding, and his belief, his concept of what belief in God means, he says, there is no question that this person has a share in the world to come. He says, that's why the Gemara says that even a goy, a person from the nations who studies Torah, has a law, has a status of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. He says, and the essence of everything and the whole objective of Moses' Torah is to teach a person how to perfect himself in his relationship to God. Just like King David says, I place God before me always. He says, and Moses himself was only praised not because of his halachic performance, but Moses was praised because of the great level that he reached in terms of human perfection. And the Torah praises Moses when it says, and the man Moses was very humble, more humble than any other human being. So you see, the Rambam says that the objective of performing all the mitzvahs is only one thing, to perfect the gavra, to perfect the person. He says, and that is the ultimate objective of every mitzvah. Because anivus, humility, in our system represents the ultimate level. Because humility means a person understands truthfully his station in terms of his relationship to God and where he is in the universe. If a person understands that, he has to be very humble. That's why Moses received that praise. So the Rambam says that he says, and there is no question, the Rambam says, that the whole purpose of the Torah and the mitzvos is in order to perfect an individual. He says, because you can't say, as others say, he wants to rule out the possibility that others say that mere performance of mitzvos is perfection. He says, this can't be. He says, because the Torah says that nations will look to Yisrael, to the Jews, and they will say that this is a very intelligent and wise nation. Now, if the laws didn't have any reasons, and if they didn't lead to any perfection, why should anybody recognize such a system? So you see from this passage in the Torah that the objective of the entire Torah is really to perfect the personality of the individual. He says, and there is no question that the Avos, our fathers, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and Noah, and Adam the first, who didn't keep any of the laws of the Torah. Definitely there's no question that they are not penalized. But certainly, he says, since they were able to achieve and to understand true knowledge, and they were able to perfect themselves to their utmost degree, that they are on the highest level of humanity. He says, and perfection is not dependent upon being involved in prayer and fasting and crying without any knowledge or without any true understanding of what the concept of emunah, of faith, is, he says. And the final principle is that nothing exists eternally besides the knowledge of God. So that from the Rambam supports in the letter what I mentioned in that he says in the Yad HaChazaka, that insofar as the person is concerned, the Ben Noach and the Yisrael are identical. There is no difference. It's true in the halachic system, because that's how halach has to work with a legalistic perfected framework, so there has to be differentiations. But it is not because of any kind of it's not an indication of any kind of superiority in terms of Adam, in terms of man, because man's ability to perfect himself is totally dependent upon his das, upon his knowledge. And we have with us today Reverend David Davis, who with his knowledge and with God's help has been able to overcome, to be able to see through the false ideas that unfortunately most of this world
After all the introductions that I have received in the last week, I look around to see who they're talking about. And I think that was very warm. It was very gracious of you. Rabbi Zucker has been a friend and an ally to us this week that we've been here, and I think it's a credit to this yeshiva producing young men such as this. And hopefully that you sitting here will not only follow in the footsteps of your teacher, but the footsteps of this man that has gone out and has had the courage of conviction to stand for what the Torah has taught. And this is really, we are living in exciting times. When you travel the country as we do and we speak, we see that there is an excitement among the Gentiles, that the Gentiles are tired of the organized religion. They're tired of the things that have been presented to them. There's no reality to it. You find people that are moving from one group to another group, one denomination to another denomination, and in the end, finally, just throwing their hands up in despair and stopping, quitting. With the media coverage that we have received in the last month since March the 20th, we have had literally hundreds of letters and calls from all over the world for people, and almost universally the letters are, I've tried, I've given up, I quit. And that you have given us hope. Can you help us? And then we send material out for them. One of the most unusual letters that we've received is from another country. If any of you saw the news pieces, CNN News started off showing East Tennessee. If you've never been there, you should come. Beautiful part of the country. I know you all think God created Jerusalem and then the rest of the world, but in East Tennessee, we think it kind of started there. it's a great place. But then they were talking about all the churches, and then there's the church without the steeple, and they go in and do the piece. I went to the post office one day, opened the box. Here is a letter. I can tell that it's an international letter because of the paper it was on. I turn around and look at the address: to the church without a steeple, Athens, Tennessee, USA. That's the only address on it. It got here. It got to Athens. I opened the letter. I read it. It was from a young lady in Italy. I don't recall the name of the city. She was raised in a, quote, Christian environment. She married into a Catholic family. She said she can't go to church anymore. The last time I went, it left me nauseous. She stopped. So, the moral of the story of what I'm teaching, that without the reality of the Torah is the Word of God. And our inspiration, our fervor, our fire, the motivating action in our lives should come from the Torah of God. We should not rely on any outside stimuli other than the Torah. And whether we live the type of life we live or whether we die, we should live our life and die the death that Hashem has for us in accordance to the precepts that are presented to us in Torah. There are two vital relationships that we can have or that are seen in the Torah. To amplify what the rabbi said, we have the commandments given to the sons of Jacob. Then we have the commandments that are given to the rest of the world. And as you live out the commandments and the mitzvot that God has for you, then you are proving the will of God, so to speak, in your life. As we, as Ben Noah, live out the revelation that God has given to us, and we live out these precepts, then we're living and God's place for us. We realize that the Torah is the inheritance of the sons of Jacob. It's an eternal inheritance. That you are to be the light of the world. And that if we have instruction, it must come from the guardians and the teachers of the Torah. Someone asked me last evening, do you view yourself as a second-class citizen? As Rabbi Zucker and I spoke, if we see God's overall plan, there are no second class, there are no first class. There are people that are living out the position that has been given us. So, what do we do? We study. But we look to the Torah, but we also look to the sons of Jacob for the instruction from Torah. And then, as I stated last evening, and in speaking in Teaneck, we were in Teaneck, right? We don't have all the answers. I don't have all the answers. If you ask me a question, I give the wrong answer. Well, tell me the right answer, and the next time I'll try to get it right. If we miss it, straighten us out. If we had all the answers and I knew everything, why would I be here? You know, I'd be somewhere else. So we're on a journey. And we're in this state of flux, a constant state of flux. And we move and we flow according to the knowledge and the understanding that we receive. I, as well as you, can only do what I know to do. But we all must search and seek to find our place in this master plan of God. Now, I could talk all day, but I want to give you an opportunity for you to ask questions. So you should have some good questions. Now, if you don't, Rabbi Zucker's going to be embarrassed because he's taken me to free school, 500 kids. They were sharp. Sharp kids. We spoke, they talked. Then after we dismissed, there were maybe 30 kids come up, spent nearly their entire lunch period speaking with us then. So, now, you've got to outshine the kids. So, just raise your hand, be recognized, and we'll go from there. Yes, sir?
Yeah, I would like to know, what source, maybe the Torah, even started you off on this pursuit of trying to find out what the knowledge of the Torah is. What made you change your mind and realize that this is what you wanted to do?
Okay, that's going to take a little time to answer, and I think this is a good place for this. You must realize that I started as a, quote, born-again Christian. That in seeking the truth and trying to find out my place in the plan of God, I come to the realization that I didn't know anything about Jesus that's in the Bible. So I proceed without an understanding of the historical setting and the time in which this man lived, then I could not understand anything about this guy that I was supposed to know everything about. So I started on a pursuit of understanding the historical setting and the times in which these events that were so important to my life took place. So in order to do this, you've got to realize that this was 73-74, and we're sitting in rural East Tennessee. And rural East Tennessee, there were not very many Jews around. And those that were not very religious. So I set out to put this, what is referred to as the Gospels, in some kind of chronological order and some time of time frame, and interpret the words there, not in the sense that we understood them in 1973-74, but understand the words as they would be in the time that they were spoken in the Second Temple period. I tried to find Jewish books. Now, you'll laugh when, how many Talmuds have y'all seen? I've never seen any. I'd heard about it, but I'd never seen them. I didn't even know how to say it. And with my southern accent, some say I still don't. It's kind of like chocolate pie. Sometimes you can't say it, but I know what it is. So I set out looking, not for a Talmud, but see, we were taught when I was in school something about this oral law business. You know, what oral law? I didn't know anything about oral law. So I was speaking in Houston, Texas. And I just happened to ask the preacher in the church I was speaking, I said, "You got any Jewish bookstores around?" Because I looked for Jewish bookstores. No Jewish bookstores. And I went in over there, and this guy, I said, "Have you got some kind of book about the oral law or something?" He said, "Yeah, it was a Mishnah, something." You know, I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, "I believe I want one." You know how much those things cost? How many of you have bought one? I mean, I had to get a cosign on my gold card. But I bought it. I read it. Lots of luck. I mean, it didn't mean anything to me. You know, I couldn't find anything. So we're talking about a learning process. And it took years and years, and I was buying anything and everything I could get a hold of and read. But no one, I was calling rabbis and trying to get rabbis to talk to me. No rabbis would talk to me. They didn't know what, I mean, what do you do with a goyim? I mean, you convert him. But what if he doesn't want to be converted? Well, we don't have time for you. You know, kind of like a dog, throw him a bone, pat him on the head, send him away. And that's kind of the way it was. And then we're learning and we're learning. There are a lot of books. In fact, since 1964, there have been over 72 books written about this historical Jesus guy. And I kept coming on these things of these laws of Noah. I'd read a little bit every once in a while. Didn't know anything about it. Then, in 1985, Rabbi Harvey Falk wrote a book called Jesus the Pharisee. And in this book, Jesus the Pharisee, he quotes from a letter by Rabbi Yaakov Edmund. Okay? And then he goes in and he sets forth this Noahide concept. And I said, hey, that's it. That's it. That's the whole thing. Then I go into this, quote, New Testament that we have, and you know what I find in there? Now, I've already realized this thing is not a Christian document the way I'd been taught. See, we're looking now at about 16, 17 years of intense study. I found out that Jesus, this guy Jesus, he didn't go, he wasn't baptized. You know where he, what happened to him? When he went into the water, if he was in the second temple period, what did he do? He went to the mikveh. I mean, what's a mikveh? So then I spend about 6 or 8 months studying the, I believe, 7 laws of the mikveh. Is that not correct? In the tractate mikveh. And I said, hey, this guy never went to a baptistry. He wasn't ducked in the name of the Father, the Son, the Holy Spirit, forward, backwards, or sideways. And that these other guys never told anybody to go to a baptistry, because that was alien to their society and their culture. So these books, and we continue to learn. Then around 86, this thing just began to snowball. And it was like a flood of information and knowledge coming our way. So to be here, you can't hardly get here from there. And you don't do it in a day, you don't do it in a week, or a month, or a year. And we must learn, I have had to learn to be patient. Because I'd want to bring people along the line that it took me, 73 to 91, how many years is that? 18, 19 years? You know, I want to bring them in 18 to 19 minutes. It doesn't work. So we must learn to be slow. We must be compassionate. And we, of all things, must be patient. Answer each question as they ask. Don't give them more than they can handle. I've killed people, literally killed them spiritually, by dumping a whole load on them. I did it ignorantly, but I did it nonetheless. So, it must be patient, it must be slow, it must be methodical. All right. Now, that's the longest answer I'll give you all morning, I promise you. Yes, sir. Okay. Good answer. Good question. When you study, and by the way, I've done a comparative study of all ancient religions. And do you realize that in all ancient religions, whether it be Hinduism or whatever, that everything they have, they borrowed from Judaism? One aspect of it, one facet. And they built a whole religion around that particular facet. So you come back, and the bottom line, each religion has a flood story. Each religion, you study the ancient Sumerians, the Akkadians. They have the same story that we find in Torah. Different names, same story. Boat, animal, only survivor. So, if you come back from a pure intellectual standpoint, that if you keep coming back to a common denominator, and then you begin to look into this religion that's called, see, I don't like to call it Judaism because that's, you know, there's so many isms around, that is Torah living. So if you take these common denominators, then it stands to reason that this must be the only one. If there is a normative path, and you have to put that hypothetical if there is a normative path, this is the normative path. All the others are just cheap imitations. Well, there might be, but that's what I said, if there is a normative path. But I would rather live my life believing what I believe than going out and bowing to Buddha, or going to church and praying to Jesus, or going to the Catholics and bowing to Mary. I'd rather have a direct line to this guy we call Hashem or whatever up there. Well, I don't. But according to the knowledge and the historical data that I have, the information that is available, the ancient sources, the most ancient sources, this is the true path. Okay? Yes, sir.
How do you think the other Christian theologians view you? They view you as a traitor? They view you as an upstart?
Well, do you want me to quote specifically what they said?
Well, or do you want me to, these holy walls, we can use that type of language.
Well, no, they haven't called me, you know, they haven't used any swear words, but I'm a dog that has returned to my vomit. I'm a swine wallowing in the mire, a false prophet, a deceitful worker, the devil in the flesh.
That's what they called
it? Yeah. And you know what I do? I just smile at him and go on. And you know, Solomon in 26, the proverb, 26 proverb, says you answer a fool according to his folly. So you just let them, if they are inquiring, you give them honest answers. If they want to revert to name calling and character assassinations, you just leave them alone. You can't deal with people like that.
But this is among the leaders are calling you.
Yes.
Right? But what about the people on the whole? Like, in other words, not the leaders of the various nominations, but their followers. Do they feel a hatred? Do they feel any kind of...
It's a threat.
They feel a threat.
Our very existence is a threat. And it's somewhat humorous, too. It seems that the more that... All right, just put it this way. What's the chances of a little hick preacher in Tennessee having this mug stuck on the front page of the Wall Street Journal? Could you manipulate that? Could you make it happen? Or do you just accept that as divine providence? I'd rather believe that there's a God that's ruling in the affairs of men than that I was smart enough to figure all this out. So, yes, they perceive us as somewhat of a threat, but they're also somewhat enamored with us because they can't figure it out. Now, watch this. This is good because one guy said, this is what you should do. Someone asked one of the men in the church, says, where did David Davis get all the money to get on TV and get his picture on the front page of the Wall Street Journal? He said, I should have told him that there was a Jewish guy in Israel giving $5 million and told him to do what he wanted to with it. And when he ran out of that, he was going to give him some more. I said, you should have told him. Now, hey, would that pop their guard? I mean, you know, that's what they want to believe anyway. So, you know, just read it. He said, no, he didn't do that. But it would have been great if that had happened. Yes, sir.
At least to me, it would seem that the masses are not really interested in a pure search for knowledge as opposed to just being told, just given. In other words, they're not really looking for a search that they would undergo themselves, mm-hmm. but rather just been given information in terms of what is truth, what is reality about okay. existence and about a creator,
yeah.
and be happy with that, you know, and not really...
You know,
be interested in a
long,
ongoing pursuit.
Okay, let's just...
As opposed to, let's say, what they know of or what you're involved in, you really, it's a personal investigation. You know, how do you see trying to reach those type of people that are, you know, they're not really in that direction?
Okay, well, see, people, as Rabbi Chait alluded to, people are people. Now, how do you motivate a non-observant Jew to be observant? Is there not a certain amount of apathy among Jews? I mean, in our area. Yeah, in our area. There are just not very many religious Jews in, like, for instance, Knoxville is a city of approximately 200,000. There's not an Orthodox Shul in Knoxville. Chattanooga, Tennessee has 1,800 Jewish families. There is an Orthodox shul there, and I think perhaps 40 families hold membership in the shul. All right? So it's not just a problem with the non-Jew. The Jewish community is faced with the same apathy that we have in the non-Jewish community. So it's a people problem. What are you going to do to activate them? Our position has been this, and see, I come again from a fundamental Christian background. We've seen all the little programs, all the pumps, all the primes, and you try to get people involved because of a party or whatever, it doesn't work. Do you know where it comes from? Right here. You spoke of that, Rabbi. It's got to come from the heart. People have got to want it. All right, who do we minister to? Those that want it. If they don't want it, we're nice, we're friendly, but why waste my time trying to convince someone of something that they're not going to be convinced of? So there are literally, again, as a result of the news media, literally hundreds of people out there that want what is being offered. So we give it to them, we share it with them, and we're not having to do any advertisement. God is advertising for us. I mean, this morning, Rabbi Zucker and I were on WABC for 30 minutes. What would 30 minutes of radio time cost on WABC? We couldn't afford it. What would it cost front page Wall Street Journal? You can't buy it. CNN News. I mean, you've got to kill somebody in a real weird way to get on that. You can't just kill them. You got to do it in a weird way. So we were on headline news. We were on CNN News. ABC Night Watch. We were on it. You can't buy this. So the message is getting out, and it's getting to those that want it and need it. And God is seeing that it's getting done. Okay? Yes, ma'am. Okay, one at a time, please. Well, I don't. That's what other people call me. I have never called myself a reverend. But the fact is that people do that as a term of respect, and you're not going to embarrass them by saying, hey, don't do it. This morning on the radio, I tried to get the guy. I said, you know, just call me David. And he says, we have the right to ordain people. So he ordained me again. I got my second snicker right there on the radio this morning. So. A lot harder. Okay, let's see. We'll have to have help. My wife can answer this one for you. Mm-hmm.
Really still believe Jesus more, and they really still some people, and they really don't understand the concept of Judaism. They look at it not as a threat, but as something very foreign.
Mm-hmm.
So they must think that, why would you attach yourself to something that's so strange? Okay. And how do you, I mean, if you start off with the fact that they think Jesus is the most strangest thing in the world, how do you view the religion as a person that's totally different? And now you're affiliating yourself. I don't even...
Okay, the people will see that they know that the Bible, and when they speak of the Bible, they're talking from Genesis through Revelation. That they view the Bible as been written by Jews, with the exception of the possibility of the book of Luke, and they think that he was probably a Gentile. So when they see that, they realize this is a Jewish document about Jews. But when it comes to the place of bringing it out of antiquity to present-day living, they can't do that, because they have been instructed from their youth that there's one way to God, and that's through the born-again experience, and everyone else is going to hell. So then you come in and you try to share with them the same words, for instance, in the New Testament that they would use to show everlasting, eternal, forever. Then you go back to Torah and you find out that this is a memorial forever. You shall teach this unto your sons and your sons' sons forever. Then you say, when did God change his mind? They said he didn't. Well, what are you going to do with this? Then the telephone rings and they're gone. See, it's a matter of education. And it's a matter of thinking, and most people never think for themselves. They let someone else do the thinking for them. Most people that go to church go in, as they do in a lot of the synagogues, And see, it's refreshing to me to see as many religious people as I've seen this week. I've seen more religious people this week than I've seen in my life. And I've spent months in Israel. So that tells you that I was not around the right type of people, right? But I've seen more religious people this week than I've seen in my life. Yeah. So, the apathy's there, and the shuls that I've been in, they do the same thing they do in the church. They go in, they sit down, and they shift to neutral and kind of idle through. And then when it comes to the prayer services in the synagogues, I've seen that they are speaking so fast that you can't understand anything's going on. So let's get through this so we can get to something else. Well, why can't we enjoy what we're doing? If you don't enjoy praying, just close it and stay at the house. But if we come to pray, if we come to diving, let's do it with a respect to God and not just to get through it because this is what I'm supposed to do because it's today. So excuse me? Well, no, we need some oomph. We need to put some soul back in our worship. It's not just reading a Siddur. There's got to be some soul. See, we've got this vertical relationship. Forget about this horizontal thing. Let's get the vertical thing right. And when we get this vertical relationship right, then we'll reach out in the manner that we should. We'll have this love. We'll have this compassion. We won't have to say, well, I got to help this poor guy because it's a mitzvah. We'll do it because we love him. We won't be kind to someone because, hey man, that's another start here. I got six good mitzvahs a day. You know? So we get in this counting mitzvah business instead of realizing this is a relationship with God. And see, it's not just an intellectual thing, and it must begin with intellect, but we got to have some soul in it. Read the prophets. As I spoke last night, the prophets, the Torah is the revelation of God. The prophets are people living out the revelation that God's given them. What did the prophets do when they saw the people not living for God? It broke their hearts. You remember Isaiah? He said, I'm unclean. I live among unclean people. And then he began to confess his sins. And he confessed the sins of the people. He got somewhat emotional about it. You know, the intellect's great, but let's get some fire in this thing. Let's get some soul into it.
You mentioned that you turned to God into the scholars of the house of Jacob. I'm just curious, how do you determine which, there's many factions in Judaism.
Okay.
And how did you make the determination which group to turn to? Is it just a function of which rabbis reached out to you and think they're...
Well, I'll answer it real quick. It's easy. God chose the ones he wanted us to have. Why? Because I started off in the Reform. I was too religious for them. Okay, we go to conservative. I go to the conservative. And hey, I just want to study. I want to learn. They invite me to speak on the seven mitzvahs. I come in, I was talking about idolatry. See, now that's a real easy one, just idolatry. Breeze right over that one. So I said, idolatry is the belief in the one God as he is revealed in the Torah. Yes? Well, what do you do with Jesus and the Trinitarian concept? A belief in the Trinitarian concept is paganism, it's idolatry. The world comes to an end. For the next hour and 15 minutes, I defend God, Torah, and the Moses, and these people are defending Jesus, the Trinity, and Christianity. You know they invited me back the next week, right? The doors were shut. Okay, we go, and I'm sorry, I went to the Lubavitch. These are the guys to see. They promote the seven mitzvahs, right? Everybody knows that. Rabbi Schneerson says so. So if he says it, it's like E.F. Hutton when he, So I call, I try to get in touch with the Lubavitch. I call. Everybody gives me this one name. I call this guy no less than 30 times. You know how many times he returned my call? Zip. So I keep calling. I'm calling other people. Now see, this is not so good for people that are supposed to be the light to the going. You know, it's not so good. So I finally get this big Lubavitch rabbi that's got all the answers. What does he tell me to do? To buy this book. Hey, I've already worn one out. And then I said, are you aware? And I told him of some other books. And he says, well, what more do you need? That was the end of it. So, by this time, I'm just a little irritated, right? So, this guy in Chattanooga, Mr. Levy, works with a man in my assembly, Gary Buchanan. He said, our rabbi is a very learned man. Your pastor needs to call him. Big deal. I'm tired of calling. I threw the number in the trash can. Okay? 3 or 4 months rock on. Mr. Levy says, Gary, your pastor hasn't called my rabbi. So out of respect for Mr. Levy, I call this rabbi. You know, here we go again. Now, by this time, we're several years into this thing. By this time, I'm fed up. So I tell the rabbi who I am, make an appointment. We come down. I said, all right, let's just cut through all the bull. I said, you are a son of Jacob. The Torah is your inheritance. You're to teach the non-Jew. Will you teach me, yes or no? If you do, let's get it on. If not, I'm going back to Athens. He says, when you put it that way, do I have a choice? That began the relationship that we have with Rabbi Michael Katz. From that relationship, we have been introduced to a lot of people. This man right here has been as instrumental as anyone. This man right here, the warmth and the love that he showed me on the telephone. I have found more love, compassion, and understanding since I have been here this week than I found in the years that I've been in the movement trying to find it. Now, that's the truth. I'm not preaching to you. I'm telling you the truth now. It's here. Okay, so Hashem has sent us where He's wanted us in the time that it was needed. Yes, sir. But let's wait. You've been once before. Let's give. If anybody else, nobody else, we'll get back. Yes, sir. Okay. When I first started in this, I am blessed by being surrounded with some great people. They're great people. They're thinking people. First of all, a lot of the people that I'm associated with felt sorry for me. They really thought I was going crazy. No, I'm serious.
Because you rejected Jesus? Is that
what? Well, I mean, what would you think if Rabbi Chaik Khan said, and what's your name?
Leslie.
Leslie? Do you know Moses probably never existed? And do you realize that this portion of the Torah is just not exactly correct?
Where's the door?
Yeah. And then, you know, in Sanhedrin 56b, that's really not quite like it is. Now, what are you going to do?
Not stick around very long.
Right. But, now, if you love Rabbi Chaik, what would you do? You know, see, that's you've got the scared rabbit syndrome.
Right.
Now, if you really loved Rabbi Chaik, what would you do?
Try to set him straight.
No.
I would?
No, not. You would be sympathetic with him. One. He is your teacher. So you're sympathetic with him. He has taught you a lot. You're indebted to this man. So you're going to be patient with him. You're going to listen to what he has to say. You're going to try to subtly get him to see that, hey, Moses was okay, the Torah is okay, the Talmud is okay. But what if Rabbi Chaik really proved to you that these things weren't exactly kosher? How are you going to respond? You either run or you get on board. And you begin investigating what he's teaching you. You're no longer just taking his word as the Rosh. You are looking for yourself. And you are validating outside of his teaching that what he's saying is correct. So the people that I'm associated with, they loved me. They cared for me. They knew that I was dedicated. If I'd have been a run-of-the-mill, we call in East Tennessee a jackleg preacher, they wouldn't give me the time of day. They knew I was honest. So, that's it. Yes, sir.
Judaism is not a proselytizing religion, and they don't go out actively in terms of bringing in converts. You have gone to a certain point in terms of your fundamentalism, and you have your beliefs. But in terms of your own studies and research the last 18 or 19 years, do you see the possibility of your wanting to convert and come to Jesus?
Okay, back to the initial to the initial concept. Number one, God has given two distinct programs, one for the Jew, one for the non-Jew. If God had wanted to institute and made everyone Jews, he passed up a golden opportunity when the ark landed. Now, we do not find in Torah any formula for conversion. We go to the Talmud. Circumcision, the mikveh, and the offering of a sacrifice in the time of the temple. But we get that from the Talmud, and I'm not disputing the Talmud, but there's no formula in the Torah for conversion. So if God had wanted everyone to be Jews, he missed the boat, so to speak. There is a direct, in the days of the Mashiach, there will be the restoration of the 70 nations. What will be the code of ethics for the 70 nations? The seven mitzvahs of Noah. Now, who will enforce the seven mitzvahs of Noah on the 70 nations? Truth will go forth from Zion. Will the whole world, the non-Jews, will be established back. The seven mitzvahs of Noah will be universal. And Hashem will have specific non-Jews in places of leadership, and that's the reason this revival, so to speak, is not a self-made phenomena. This is the resurrection of the precepts that God has given, and I believe they are heralding the days of the Messiah. So you should be teaching us how to instruct the non-Jew. Because during the days of the Mashiach, there's not going to be any question. So we go out, the nation says, it's time for Shavuot. Well, I don't believe I want to have anything to do with it. That's good. I pick up the phone, I call Rabbi Zucker, and I said, hey, the people in my domain do not want to come up to Jerusalem. He said, that's okay. He goes over to the temple, pushes a button, no rain for a year. You know, comes up next year. Fellas, I think it's time for us to go up to Jerusalem with a little offering. Sounds like a good idea to me. So, see, it's not an accident. So, there's no need. I'd say, why should I? When I have this viable, pliable relationship with God based on Torah principles, I'm happy with it. I love it. Yes, sir.
Christians in general, non-Jews, are growing tired. Organized religion with the church. And you see that reflected, I think, in the fundamental Pentecostal television programs. And I wanted to ask you your opinion on one particular thing. I've noticed that has been a certain... Well, the best example is I was going through the channels the other night. I see this guy on television who operates out of Dallas, Texas, who's a big...
He's my friend, Robert Tilton. Yeah, I'm lying. He's not my friend. Send your money to God, put my address on it. P.O. Box 442, Athens, Tennessee, and your blessings on the way.
Robert Tilton, this particular broadcast was broadcasting from Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
His backdrop being the Western Wall.
Yes.
And he was wearing a palace around
his head. Yes.
And
he has no morals, by the way. And I'm not... I'm sorry, he doesn't.
You know, I've heard him speak in Hebrew, using Hebrew... several... Not just him in particular, but don't, you know... Watch him.
Okay, all right, but get to the point, so we can get on.
Your opinion seems to be a certain Judaification, if you will.
All right, see, that's the whole deal. The church, as I alluded to earlier, they start with the Jewish concepts and immediately depart. So they look Jews. Now, let me ask you this, point in order. Can you be pro-Israel and anti-Jewish?
Yes.
Who said yes?
I
did. All right. Can you be pro-Israel and anti-Jewish? Do you know who the most anti-Jewish people in the world are? Tighten up your seatbelts. No. The numbers-wise are the fundamentalist evangelical Christians who are pro-Israel. Do you realize that if the fundamentalist Christian movement had their way, they would do something that Hitler did not do? Do you realize they would eradicate the Jews from the earth? You ever thought of that? Why? They would convert them to Christianity. If they convert them to Christianity, you're no longer a Jew, you're a Christian. So they use, and this is the reason that I say that we need to expose Christianity for what it is. It is paganism. It's heresy. Robert Tilton is a false prophet. And according to Deuteronomy chapter 18, he should die. He should be put to death because he is deceiving millions of people. He's lying on God. He's lying on the Torah. And he's deceiving people. Forget about the money. He's a liar. And he's a deceitful worker. And he needs to be exposed. But see, the Jewish community doesn't want to rock the boat. Why? Because the fundamentalist Christians go to Israel to support the economy. So we compromise Torah for dollars. We're afraid of programs. We're afraid of ghettos. But what about the Torah? Oh, that's fourth or fifth down the line. No, it's Torah first. And see, the Jewish community needs to get a hold of that. The Christian community needs to get a hold of that. And when they do, they won't be Christians. Unless you want to use the word Christian as anointed, and I'm anointed. You're anointed. Yes, sir.
Yeah, your religious observance is based around the observance of the seven nullified laws. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know, in terms of your, what you call your church, you know, your religious... Like, what kind of a positive program is it happening? How do people, in a positive way, you know, relate to God, get close to serve God? What is done, for example, in particular types of service?
Okay, see, this is something that's probably foreign to you, and it's not an insult to you, by the way. But we get tight on study. We study. It's a fire. It's a fervor. You see, you come to our conference in November. You'll see people that start at 10 o'clock in the morning and we study and discuss to 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. Not just 10 or 15. The clappers have been there. You're talking 100, 200 people here that are studying all day and all night.
Well, that's how far that I will. That's basically what the basic fundamental... commandment that we're involved in is the study of Torah. So you're telling me that basically the most fundamental...
How much more fundamental can you get?
When
we get together for service, they're
supposed to be studying, in other words.
Yeah, we're studying. Alright, again, I can pray, but here's what happens. And here's what we're afraid of. and we guard against. We have seven mitzvahs. If we add to those, then we are creating a new religion. And the Talmud prohibits the creation of a new religion. So each individual ben Noah has to choose how he will relate to God outside of those seven mitzvahs. We can make suggestions, but we can't write a book. If we start a siddur, where is it going to stop? So, I do more than the seven. But I don't get up in my assembly or on my tapes and tell everybody what I do. I tell them to... See, the thing about it, nobody really should have to tell you to pray. No one should really have to tell you, Rabbi, to study. That's where that oomph comes in. I pray because I want to pray. I study because I want to study. It's not because I have to. Okay?
Just going to sit for a moment. What the Reverend is saying is really what the Rambam says. That if Ben Noah can do mitzvahs of the Torah, but he's doing it on a voluntary basis because of the fact that he wants to benefit from the performance of the
mitzvah.
But he's not saying, in essence, that this is a part of his code which he's obligated to do.
It's not. All right, let's get this gentleman right here. Yes, sir.
Rabbi, man, I'm preempting my original question, and I want to ask you if I may.
Okay.
What is the position of the B'nai Noah as far as we have the Sabbath?
Okay.
We have the Shabbos. But now, the B'nai Noah are exempt. They don't have to observe the Shabbos.
Okay.
Do you foresee in the B'nai Noah community selection of one day as a specific day for them to study and or prayer? And a personal question, as you pray, what is your form of prayer?
I'll answer the second question first, that my form of prayer is personal between me and God.
Do you recite?
No, I can. But see, if I start giving a formula out, as you know, see, we have a term in East Tennessee. Y'all ever heard of the jiggling pin and the wobbling shaft? Now, that's what Rabbi Chait is. See, he's the jiggling pin and the wobbling shaft around here. He holds everything together. All right? Now, if I start telling my people how I pray and the formula that I use, you know what they're going to do? They're going to start emulating me. I can make suggestions to them. But what I do is personal between me and God. So I can make specific suggestions to them, and I would be very broad in my suggestions and let them choose for themselves. That way, I am not creating another aspect of, you've got to pray this morning at 7:05, read Psalms 122 through 138. You prayed this evening. I'm not going to do that. Now, it might come to that one day, but I don't foresee it. Would you, according to Halak?
It's a delicate issue. It's one that you have to think into carefully. I think you realize the problem. It would have to be... I can't say at this point without being further...
No. Well, see, we've discussed this. Rabbi Katz, there are people within our movement that have wanted to write a siddur. All right? They wanted it. Rabbi Katz is very adamant, and he's opposed to it, because if we do that, then we are in essence adding to, and we are going against the Rambam, and we're going against tradition. Okay, that was the second part of your question. The first part, dealing with the Sabbath end of it, I believe. Is that correct? All right, we are, according to Talmud, something just stopped. According to the Talmud, we are prohibited from observing the Sabbath as do the Jews. But when we look at Genesis, that, you know, God could count to seven. And when it got to seven, what did he do? He stopped counting and started over again. Now, Adam could count to seven. Noah could count to seven. And isn't it interesting that for hundreds of years we had day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six, day seven, then day one again. Then we had the first month, the second month. We didn't have names on them. We just had numbers. So the Ben Noah is there, and he is aware of the cycle and the times and the seasons of God. Now, am I going to observe the Sabbath as do the Jew? No. But in the Torah, God blessed the Sabbath and rested. But the Ben Noah is prohibited from taking total rest. But I can acknowledge the Sabbath as a day that Hashem did rest, and that this is the day that He's blessed. But I'm not going to light candles, break bread, and do all these other things. Well, sure. If it's good kosher wine. I prefer Carmel. A light rosé. Let's get one of these guys that have. We'll get around. After we get around, everybody will come back. And Rabbi, you tell us when it's time to stop. Okay, just pull the plug. I'm like a train. I can disconnect anywhere. All right, yes, sir.
Do you really want to know?
All right, I have the Sansino Talmud. I cannot study Talmud. You know why I can't study Talmud? I don't know Hebrew, and I do not know Rashi script. So I can read Talmud. Am I reading it? Why would I want to read it? So I can see the framework from which I am to operate. Am I concerned with every halakhic ruling that is in Talmud? No. I just want a general working knowledge, because it's not for me. All right, the Midrash, the 10-volume set, I've read it all. The Zohar, I've read it all. I have the Judaica books, the Judaica books on the Bible. I wasted money on the Sansino books of the Bible. I have the Encyclopedia Judaica. I have all the Masorah publications, their books of the Bible, the commentaries. If you come to my library, I've got about $20,000 worth of books conservatively. They're not just on the shelf to look pretty. I've read them. I studied them. I have the Ramban's commentary. I have the Kugmash Rashi, the Silverman's edition. I read this. I do the Torah readings, the weekly Torah and Haftorah readings. Last year I went through Rashi on the Torah and Haftorah readings. This year I'm going through the Ramban's. Next year I'll go through Malbim. So, you know. Yeah.
We cling to a heritage, and which is based upon revelation in Sinai.
Yes.
And our service of God is based upon our intellectual conviction. Of course, our emotions are channeled based upon the intellectual conviction.
Exactly.
But yet, we are searching for truth, and we cling to God through knowledge.
Okay.
However, our observation of most other religions in this world are based upon not channeling of the emotions, but the exploitation of the emotions. That's where they seem to relish and thrive. How do you overcome that, approaching people who are used to that type of thinking?
We explain to people that their emotions excuse them if it does not totally deceive them. Again, we must emphasize patience and long-suffering. Now, someone such as these people that are involved with Robert Tilton that have had emotional experiences that have spoken in tongues and God has talked to them, I don't care how much you try. No, it's not humorous, because it's real to them. See, one lady I spoke with this week says, I used to laugh at the Christians. After she talked with me about 5 hours, she started feeling sorry for them. Big difference. Now, these people are searching for God. And you tell them God didn't talk to them. They know He did. They're praying. They're searching. They're looking. But, see, here's another aspect. Do you realize how sensual religion is? Do you really realize how sensual religion is? You know why the pagan religions were so popular? Because of the sensuality of it. And when the people in these pagan religions says, if you could feel what I feel, well, you have. But it wasn't a religious thing. It was a sexual thing. And you don't know unless you counsel with people, as I have, how so close it is. And then you must educate these people to the emotional exploitation that's going on. Now, does anyone want to acknowledge the fact that they're wrong? No. And then when they find out that they've been deceived, they're embarrassed. And we've got to help them over being embarrassed. Say, hey, I was just as bad as you. Were it not for the hand of Hashem, I would be where you are. So we must be kind. We must be patient. Now, this is the problem, again, and I use these opportunities to come back with the Jewish community. I found that the Jewish community hasn't been real kind or real responsive to us. Because I've had rabbis tell me, well, this is what you got to do, and if you don't do it, we don't have time for you. So, what would you do if a Christian come to you and says, I want to be B'nai Noah, and then you say, well, what is your position on Jesus? Well, I believe he's the Son of God, he's God in the flesh. Now, what are you going to do with him? Silence. The silence of the lambs. What are you going to do? There's got to be an educational process. You're not going to jump down his throat and say, junk him, throw him out. He's not going to do it. We must educate, educate, educate. Now, if we could find a island of pure, virgin Gentiles that had no religion, no problem. But as long as they have religion, we must deal with them from the Pentecostal. That's the reason it's going to take people like myself, Jack Saunders, James Tabor, others who have come from evangelical, Pentecostal backgrounds in order to guide these people through the mazes. They really don't care about Deuteronomy 6:4. They don't care about that. But they really are concerned with John chapter 10, verse 31. So we've got to go to John 10 and take them back to the Torah. All right? Let's see if there's any fresh hands. If not, here's a fresh hand.
I must say I'm somewhat ashamed by your level of hasmoga, the diligence that you... Well,
I almost thought that was a put-down.
Apropos of what you said before regarding the fundamentalist Christian's attitude towards Israel, what was your reception when you were in Israel, and what is your attitude towards the state of Israel, and do you see it having a natural role in propagating these ideas to the rest of the world, and they're not fulfilling it?
I wish you wouldn't ask me that. See, if I were a Jew and I converted to Judaism, you wouldn't like me. You know why? I'd be too religious for you. And I'm not being facetious when I say this. Now, Israel, my position toward Israel, I'm pro-Israel. Why? Because I believe it's heralding the days of the Mashiach. My position is that every Jew should be in Israel. But we're comfortable in the diaspora. Of course, they were comfortable in the diaspora in the Second Temple period. Who wants to go and live on a kibbutz and fight all the time in little narrow roads when we have big interstates and cars and big fine homes? And I'm sorry, but that's it based on Torah principle. I understand that, but see, it's not my position to come and tell you what you're supposed to do. So you ask my opinion. But see, it's not my position to come in here and preach this to you. Now, I can challenge you to challenge me and the other going, other Ben Noah. But it's not my position to come in and chide you and tell you what you're supposed to do in these other areas.
What type of reception did you get?
In Israel. It's according to who I spoke with. There has been some positive. We have spoken on the telephone to the chief rabbi, Mordecai Eliyahu, Rabbi Joel Schwartz, that wrote the book, here, the little paperback on the Ben Noah, has been very warm, receptive. Rabbi Mordecai Eliyahu, Rabbi Menachem Burstyn, who is a representative of the chief rabbi, I have had a relationship with Rabbi, former Chief Rabbi Shlomo Gorin since 1986. He's a prince of a gentleman. It's like, in his presence, it's like being at the feet of Abraham Lincoln. If you can imagine that. It's been good from that standpoint, but it's still kind of a distance. Because, hey, you know, what are you going to do with the Gorin? What are you going to do with someone like me? Put him in a cage? What are you going to do? What are you going to do when there's more ben Noahs practicing the mitzvahs of Noah than there are practicing Jews? What are you going to do then? Hey, they're going to take over the synagogues. Yeah, they're going to put us out. What are we going to do with them? So there's that fear and that apprehension. And so we must realize that, as the Midrash says concerning Keturah, that I'd rather be a servant in the house of Abraham. You know the story. So that's my position. I'd rather be a servant in the house of Israel than anything I know in the world. And I don't consider that second class. I consider that the very best. Anything else would be second class. Okay? All right, well, let's get fresh hands. We're on our fresh hands. We've got one right here in the rear. Excuse me, you're going to have to speak up because my hearing aid battery's low. I have a hearing aid. Okay.
What would you
My reply would be simply, the secret things belongs to God. The things He's revealed were given us. I don't have the answer. Okay? Yes, ma'am. You'd be surprised. See, our young children do not have any problem with these things. They don't have any problems with Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and all this other, because, you know, it hasn't been indoctrinated in them. And they, I mean, see, how can you not get excited, little kids, whether they're Jewish kids or Gentile kids? How can anybody not get excited about reading about David and Goliath? You know, the big... See, I got a sermon I preach or teach from Judges. You remember Ehud? Is exceedingly, you know, the fat man? When Lefty let Fatty have it. You know, and he run the knife in so far with his left hand, the knife got hung. Or you can call that a southpaw with swift delivery. I mean, how can anybody not like this? And, you know, the kids like these action stories. And why do we have to go with a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles when you got 10 leprosy guys with the skin falling off of them going in cleaning out a whole army of Philistines? Yeah. I mean, that's good stuff. Then, you know, they want blood and guts, and you got all this, you know, all that stuff is there in the Torah. We don't have to go to Hollywood. And, you know, get Moses up on the mountain holding those hands up. Get Aaron on one side, you know, Joshua on the other side. And hey, the battle is going ebb tide out through there. Well, that's exciting stuff. I don't have to go to Hollywood and punch a movie in. I don't have to watch Chuck Norris or Rambo or any of these. I mean, hey, we got them in the Bible, real heroes. Real heroes. We got anti-heroes that have lost it and find their way back. What about Samson? He's one of the greatest stories in the Bible of a guy that started right, missed the boat, lost it all, and in the end, he regained his dignity. Great stories. Great stories. All right, I guess we've got fresh hands. We're going around for the... right here. If you haven't spoken yet, right? All right, good. Go ahead.
It was why the Torah was given at Sinai at a certain date before everybody was a ben Noah.
All right, but see, that really is kind of a misnomer a little bit, just a little bit. We have just a little bit that prior to Abraham, everyone was a ben Noah. Then Hashem enters into a covenant relationship with Abraham. Isaac is the first child of promise. See, Abraham was really a goy. Well, he really wasn't a goy because there were no goys. There were just people. Just people. And then with Abraham, there become the nation of Israel through the descendants, and then the rest of the people. Now, there's a very interesting verse, and the able rabbi can do you a good lesson on it, I know, in Genesis 26:11, where Abraham has followed all my commandments, ordinances, and statutes. Now, see, that's a good one. What does that mean? Now, did he have the precepts of Torah before Sinai? Yes, he did. But did he have all the histories? No, he didn't. All right. Okay. All right, but what about Noah? All right, let's go with Noah. The ark lands. Noah comes out, builds an altar. How did he know how to build an altar? He offered clean animals. How did he know clean from unclean? Now, see, there's a little something going on here. You know, we catch a clue. Something's happening. How did he know that? Now, go to David. The Talmud says that Adam, Saul, that David was going to be born dead. So he gave him 70 years of his life. Adam lived 930 years. How'd he do it? Had a nice crystal ball, huh? You know, there's something going on here. Yeah, but
Well, the Rambam, I think, explains it, but the purpose of the Mitzvah is to reach a level of human perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Before the Torah was given, these people were able to reach that level, even though they may not have had all the Mitzvah.
They did not have all the information.
Correct. But the reason why the Torah was given was because in order to increase the amount of people that are going to reach that level, in order to have a system available for mankind so that he who wants to learn how to protect themselves has a place to go to, that's why Sinai took place.
Exactly.
It does not exclude the possibility, for instance, of a person like Socrates, who never knew about Torah, could be on a very high level as a human being because he was a thinker and had certain ideas which my mom said were in line with the Torah. And therefore, a person like this can on his own reach a very high level in terms of as a human being. So the Torah was in order to facilitate, in order to increase, but it's not a different kind of person. There's only one kind of person. That's what the Rambam says in the
Torah. There's only one best way for a person to live.
There's only one best way to live, and that is in line with perfection. The Torah is the greatest means for perfection.
Exactly.
There are people who are able to achieve this perfection without the full benefits of Torah. But it doesn't. But in terms of humanity, God has approved humanity on the whole, it's necessary to have the Torah so that more people
can
avail themselves of it. Yeah. A new kind of person.
That's good. All right, let's.
I want to ask, is this phenomenon limited to white Christian, formerly Christian people, or is there any differentiation among the races?
Okay, that's good. Good. All right, good question. We got a lady. There's a lady in our movement from Connecticut that's black. Very good story with her. She called last year. She came to a conference. And, of course, the southern blacks, the dialect is different than, you know, southern whites. We speak our own kind of English. And I spoke with this lady. And just before the conference, she said, you realize that I'm black. Does that present any problem? I said, no, I didn't realize you were black. And it doesn't present any problem. She said, well, do I have anything to fear about racism if I come south? And see, you know, this is 1990. We don't have people riding around in A-model Fords on the running boards with white capes and pointed hats. We don't burn crosses every Saturday night anymore. You know, that's kind of out. So she's black, and she comes. She had a great time. We had other people. We had a Puerto Rican lady, a black gentleman. We received a letter about 4 months ago from a gentleman in fact we've received two from Nigeria that are blacks and that they are Noahites. So the B'nai Noah movement is for any non-Jew regardless of race. There are no racial barriers.
People don't feel any racial
Okay, let me be completely honest. Are Jews biased or prejudiced toward non-Jews? All right, but now wait a minute. I've got about three different answers already. Are they? Do you ever get together and talk about the goy? Do you ever talk about the goyim? Now, I was born and raised in rural middle Georgia. I was born and raised a bigot. But I realize that I am prejudiced. And I seek to overcome it. But I will always be prejudiced to a degree, regardless of what I do. But the blacks will say they're not prejudiced, but then they are. Jews will say they're not, but they are. All of us are prejudiced. But will we acknowledge that? Do you have enough guts to say, yeah, I am. But I deal with it. All right, let's go back. This guy right here, and then we'll come back around. Yes, sir.
Do you find any single denomination or Christianity more open to your message? In other words, do you find that fundamentalist people are more open, or Protestants or anybody here?
Okay, good point. Here we go. You know what it's going to take to make this thing go? Here's what it's going to take. Rabbi Zucker can give this word for word. He's heard it all week, more than I. Number one, the first thing that's got to happen is, do you realize that the Jewish community, the leaders in the Jewish community, has never recognized any other group of people as having a correct relationship with God according to Torah? Only the Jews? Philosophically, they talked about the Ben Noah, but there's never been any recognition of Ben Noah. All right? The Jewish community has got to, and we've got to quit playing the game, because I answer the same questions over and over and over again. As I said, put myself, Jack Saunders, James Tabor, that the leaders, put us on trial. Find out if we're some backdoor missionary group or not. Find out if we're real, and then put a stamp on us. Let us go. These people are legit. Number two, the church is not going to accept us. Period. We are anathema. We spell the death of the church. But when the rabbinic community, the Jewish community, acknowledges that we are kosher, there are hundreds, if not thousands, if not millions of non-Jews are going to say, this is not some cult, this is not some fringe deal, these people are real, and the Jewish community has said they're real. They'll come then. And not till then. We're just going to pick it up one at a time, and then some little rabbi somewhere is going to say, you better watch these people. You better be careful. You better leave them alone. You say, how do you know? Because I've been doing it for a while. So for every pat on the back, we kind of get a kick in the shin. So either take us in according to Torah, teach us, or turn us loose. So don't have time for you. Okay, right here. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I wanted to come back to the question you raised about how the Jews non-Jewish employment. My personal feeling is that the Jews the most tolerant. I'm not saying that we don't have a hold up.
All of us do.
But most tolerant. I think the Jews being the tolerant with the religious group are reacting for 2,000 years or more in the diaspora.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
Non-Jewish Gentile community.
Yes, sir.
So it's more of a defensive thing.
Yes, sir, I understand.